Good morning.
This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. Hope you're well.
Boker Tov, a little bit of a changing of the guard took place yesterday on the international front with, first of all, Andy Burnham taking over as the Prime Minister of the UK. Not a great friend of Israel's, I have to say. It's going to be interesting to see how he pans out once he's in office. We know what his standpoint is about Israel from his time as mayor of Manchester and, of course, as an active member of the Labour Party, a senior politician within the Labour Party in the UK, now prime minister. It will be interesting to see. I mean, there's no doubt that the levels of anti-Semitism in the UK have reached epidemic proportions. It's right, like almost frightening for Jews to be around in the streets. People are so nervous and very, very sensitive about their Judaism. The Jewish community have contributed so much to the UK, really, really feeling nervous right now. And also another changing of the guard, as Hamas yesterday appointed a new political leader in the form of Khalil al-Haya. And he is also a relatively interesting character based in Qatar, of course, because he wouldn't have wanted to go through all of what's going on in Gaza right now. But one of the interesting things about his appointment is not necessarily that he is appointed and what he's going to do, because it's really going to be a lot more of the same. But one of the things that I was just amused about yesterday was the fact that the Egyptian foreign minister decided to give him a call to congratulate him on his appointment. And they do say that you can judge a person by the company that they keep. And the Egyptians obviously have a very, very fascinating and a somewhat ambivalent role in what's going on in Gaza and, of course, their relationships with Hamas. It's been noticeable that even though Egypt has tried to keep friendly relations with Hamas and on this particular occasion has reached out to congratulate al-Haya on his appointment as the political leader of Hamas, the Egyptians have there's no love lost between the Egyptians and the Palestinian people in general, the residents of Gaza. And it's been extremely fascinating to watch how Egypt has navigated the last 3 years of war by not coming under any scrutiny at all for not allowing people from Gaza into Egypt. Let's not forget that Egypt has a very, very lengthy border with Gaza, and they could theoretically have opened the border and they could have been much more active in helping people. But they were not, for good reason, because the Egyptians really don't want the Palestinian problem on their territory. And they've somehow managed to avoid any scrutiny, any criticism whatsoever about behaving like this. Obviously, the spotlight being shone on Israel, as you would expect. But the way that Egypt has navigated the last few years is a case study which is worth investigating, because I think they've done an incredibly good job of avoiding having Palestinians come onto their territory and still coming out smelling of roses for being, the negotiators and the interlocutors in terms of the discussions between Hamas and Israel. I think they've done a very, very fascinatingly interesting job in all of this.
The U.S. has launched air attacks against Iran overnight, now for the 10th straight night. Anything new in the targets that were hit? I keep saying this. I say this every day. I can't get over the amount of targets that there are in Iran?
There are numerous targets, although last night the targets were really more of the same. Much focus on the Straits of Hormuz. There was another Iranian attack against a ship sailing through the Straits of Hormuz. The sites that the US Central Command hit are cities like Bandar Abbas and Sirik Island and Shiraz, and those locations all down in the southern part of the Straits of Hormuz. And it's interesting that the Iranian Deputy Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council has said the pressure lever of the Strait of Hormuz is of paramount importance to us. So the Iranians are really using the Straits of Hormuz to their best ability as best they can. And the Americans are continuing to fire their missiles and to target their attacks against sites in that area of the Straits of Hormuz. There were also attacks near to Bushehr, which is where the Iranian nuclear power plant is located. And apparently there were also attacks around the area of Isfahan, even though there was an official from the area of Isfahan who denied that there were in fact attacks. But it appears that the US has been targeting those two areas, both Bushehr and Isfahan, which are nuclear sites. I think that the most interesting revelation that's come out overnight is this piece that was published in the Washington Post, I think, which talks about, sorry, not the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal has said that Israeli intelligence has notified the US that numerous nuclear centrifuges have been moved to a different location near to the area of Natanz, where there is already a nuclear site, and they've been moved underneath a huge mountain which has been labeled Pickaxe Mountain. I'm glad that they've given it this name that we can easily pronounce, because the Iranian version of the name of the mountain is unpronounceable. So we will call it Pickaxe Mountain, which I think is what the international press also referred to.
I was wondering actually how it got that name.
So I'm not exactly sure how it got that name, but what I understand is that there's been an excavation under this mountain, which is a couple of hundred meters underground, and that it's very, very hard rock. The rock is really solid, and they've somehow managed to tunnel beneath this very, very solid rock. And the claims are perhaps up to 130, 140 meters underground. A massive, massive complex had been created there, and that centrifuges from other locations, not sure whether they were spare centrifuges or centrifuges that had been in use somewhere else and were decommissioned and moved over. All of that is not very clear, but it seems that this has been ongoing since the 12-day war took place a year ago. They've started moving these centrifuges to Pickaxe Mountain in order to protect them there. And the US administration has admitted that it's pretty difficult to get to Pickaxe Mountain. It's not so simple, even though President Trump has now publicly spoken about the possibility of attacking Pickaxe Mountain. He's used the term in some of his statements that he's made. He said it would be quite fun to see if they could drop a few bombs near to the doors of Pickaxe Mountain. I'm not quite sure whether they'll be able to actually get in there or not. I'm guessing that the Israeli intelligence has already put together a few plans as to how they might be able to get there. But I think this really sends the message that Iran is not being particularly honest when they say that they're not, you know, that they will agree not to enrich uranium, because while they're busy negotiating all of that, they're moving these centrifuges to a location that is unreachable, that they will not allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect, that they will not allow any information to be released about. So they are really, I mean, on the one hand, they could say, well, after the attacks that have taken place against our facilities, we clearly have to move them to more secure locations, which is true because they would certainly become under attack. But the other argument, of course, is if you are agreeing not to enrich uranium, why do you need these centrifuges at all? Absolutely. Never mind putting them underground in Pickaxe Mountain. So I think that this sends a very clear message of who we're dealing with, what the intentions are. And I think that we're going to hear a lot more about Pickaxe Mountain over the coming weeks and months.
Before we go on to the next political story, I do want to talk about the balcony collapse on a bakery in Jerusalem. And that is, of course, because South African Barry Levitt was unfortunately killed. Him and his wife were at the bakery. She was injured, and he was unfortunately killed by the falling balcony. What happened?
Well, I mean, just the bare facts for a moment. I mean, this was the balcony, which was on the second floor of a three-story residential building in the neighborhood of Rehavia in Jerusalem. And the ground floor is occupied, has an Angel Bakery. Angel Bakery being a very, very famous Jerusalem bakery, and has a branch of Angel Bakery on the ground floor. And there are video pictures which show exactly what happened. We just simply see the balcony on the outside of the second floor of this building just simply collapse down outside and obviously fall on the bakery, not inside the bakery, but obviously in the area outside the bakery where people were gathered. And I'm guessing people inside the bakery probably were also affected and injured because of the rubble that fell into there. And it was just a very, very frightening scene to witness right in the middle of this residential neighborhood in Rehavia in Jerusalem. And we understand that, in fact, there had been an engineer called to that location to examine this balcony earlier yesterday. That's the way that I understand things. That the engineer had come along and said, this is a big problem, and this needs to be, we need to get scaffolding here right away in order to support the balcony. Exactly what happened after that in terms of arranging, taking heed of what the engineer had suggested is not clear to me, whether there might be some negligence because the engineer had made his statement and yet nothing seemed to have been done in order to support that balcony, and it was only a few hours later that the balcony collapsed. So there was nobody actually on the balcony, but the people who were injured and, of course, the man who was killed were downstairs in that bakery when the rubble collapsed onto them. And it's just a horrendous scene, and potentially a sign of some negligence on the part of the people who had been warned that this was a problem. And I think it is somewhat symptomatic of a number of buildings in Israel where you have these balconies. Some people kind of look at them and say they look like the balcony's been stuck on with some chewing gum. You know, it kind of protrudes from the building, looking extremely precarious. Buildings are old, the balcony looks extremely wonky. Nobody in their right mind would venture out onto that balcony. But as we've now discovered, it's not only about the people who might be on there and who might fall as a result of the balcony collapsing, but it's also about the people who are underneath and the balcony falling on them. So, of course, we are very, very devastated by this loss of life, unnecessary loss of life. Somebody going about their daily business at a bakery, suddenly have a balcony fall on top of them, is just the most ridiculous scene, and something which really shouldn't be tolerated at all. And I think that, you know, there are many people who need to look at themselves in the mirror today about how the whole incident was conducted in the hours, days and weeks prior to this balcony collapsing. So our condolences to the family of the deceased. We hope that those who are injured will recover extremely quickly and will have a full recovery. But this is a very, very serious and very, very heartbreaking scene that we saw yesterday in Jerusalem.
Absolutely, too terrible. Let's talk about this pilot to try to get rid of Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's been launched. Tell me, what has it involved?
Well, the Lebanese government and the Israeli government, as we already know, have come to an agreement, have signed a peace agreement under the sponsorship of the United States. Hezbollah, of course, is standing in the way of any implementation of this agreement. And the entire focus of this peace agreement beyond doesn't really go towards saying, let's try and establish diplomatic relations, let's try and get some trade going. This is what we would typically expect to see when a peace agreement is signed. But that's not the case with Lebanon, because we've got this issue with Hezbollah, who are doing everything that they can to prevent the peace from being implemented. And so the entire focus of the peace agreement right now is how to get rid of Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's literally the focus of everything that's going on, including the work by the Lebanese government, as well as the work by Israel and the IDF in trying to achieve that. And in order to take baby steps to somehow get rid of Hezbollah from creating problems in Lebanon, three villages have been chosen to be a so-called pilot program to somehow get rid of Hezbollah. And two of these villages are not within the current area that the IDF is located. One of the villages is within the area where the IDF is currently located. The two villages that are not within the IDF-controlled area are nonetheless being controlled by the IDF in terms of their safety from a slight distance. So there is a watch, and there are IDF forces nearby, but not actually in the village. And the idea is to get rid of the IDF influence completely and to get rid of Hezbollah from those villages. And it seems like those three villages all seem to have the Hezbollah forces having been ejected already from the villages. And the trick now, the challenge, is how to get rid of the IDF, allow to the IDF to withdraw their influence and their support from those villages, and to allow the Lebanese government and the Lebanese army to assume the control there, just to allow that to take hold, to allow it to continue to work for a period of some weeks and months, in order to prove that it is possible to eject Hezbollah on a permanent basis. And then when the IDF withdraws, that they don't simply re-infiltrate and reoccupy the area. So right now, three villages are in this pilot program. The US are watching very carefully. The Lebanese army will go in, the Lebanese government will take over, the IDF will gradually withdraw, but I guess will be available to come back in should the situation require it. But for now, at least, the idea is how to get rid of the IDF influence and allow the Lebanese government to assume control over its own territory. So we will watch that, and we hope that it will be successful and that it will enable a more expansive program for the Lebanese army to take control of Lebanese territory.
That is where we leave it, Anthony Reich. Thank you. As always, we'll chat to you tomorrow morning, 7:45, with the Israel Report.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.